Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is August 22nd, 2013. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, our theme is gearing up for the fall firewalk. As I said in the last several Soleri reports, the decision coming out of the Bohemian Grove has been to lower the boom. That means the leadership is running a process where the legacy systems are going to have their liabilities renegotiated without allowing the facts of how we got to where we are emerge, or they're going to certainly do their best. So, for example, we're bailing out the banks with $27 trillion of what I would consider to be gifts. But, of course, we must bring financial accountability to retirees. And we're going through a process. We push things off. Now we're lowering the boom, and we're coming into the fall when a lot of decisions have to be made. And that's why I call it fall firewalking, because the beatdown is upon us, and there's going to be propaganda of the first order that there is now. So, and another reason I call it firewalking is for investors, it means you just got to walk through the process, and there's one hot spot after another. And what makes it worse is all the anger and frustration means that there's lots of scare talk. Let's look at a couple of the things that we're going to work through, and we're going to have to work them through when the cover stories of corruption and incompetence are wearing thin. It's all beginning to look like a plan, because it is. But that doesn't mean the day-to-day details are a plan whatsoever. Fiscal policy, we're coming into the U.S. debt limit. It's going to have to be raised. And, of course, we have the budget squabbles, no expectation of a bipartisan agreement, and I think we're going to fall back on the sequestration. So another round of automatic cuts. Then monetary policy, big question. Will the Fed start to taper in September? It's got lots of people on eggshells. And then, of course, we have the German elections and the choice of a new Fed chairman to be announced before the end of the year. So there's lots of decisions that need to be made. There are a lot of different political constituencies all needing every penny in that process. And so there's going to have to be losers in it. And that means the fighting for revenues gets stronger and stronger. One person likened it to, he says, "Oh, I get it. It's like the grocery stores. They're all putting out stale bread and raising the prices." It's a little bit of that feeling to it. Every federal and state and local agency has overhead, and increasingly what you're seeing is ridiculous stories and excuses to try and come up with more ways to claw in revenues to cover overhead. In the meantime, as I said last week, the thing to watch is not the equity markets or the price of gold, it's interest rates. Will interest rates stay in the channel or head higher? We're seeing lots of money continually drawn back from the emerging markets. It's like bringing the blood back into the heart and the lungs, away from the periphery of empire, as the sort of central headquarters needs the blood. So keep an eye on the 10 and 30 year treasury bond, because that's going to tell us a lot. Now, integrated into the price of the 10 or 30 year treasury is the ultimate ability of the U.S. to make good on its debts by printing currency that has because the currency has value to the people who get a hold of it, or because it has the ability to force people to take and circulate it. And that's why the interview with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson this week is such an important one. The weak underbelly of the U.S. system is quality control. We've had a financial mechanism for many years that can continually, through force, literally harvest the whole planet. And when you have a system like that, it's quite extraordinary financial mechanism, but you have no way of using financial accountability to rebalance the system and to bring it back into some kind of rational optimization. You know, you just keep using force to get more money, and you've literally seen certainly a federal budget that's gone out of control. So, The difficulty of this, of course, is if you have no quality control year after year after year, you continue to depend on the U.S. military performing. And the problem is, how do you create and operate an effective, high-quality, high-performance military within a system that operates this way? And it's one of the things I talked with Colonel Wilkerson about, because the greater the dependency on the U.S. military becomes, the more intense the pressure is in Washington to bring the leadership up according to political criteria as opposed to anything related to performance metrics. Anyway, more on that when we get to the interview. Money in markets, as I said last week, Fukushima continues to be an extremely important story. It's very hard to know the truth. And I think part of it is you have the equivalent of a nuclear meltdown and no one knows how to contain it. And so we're looking at a tremendously challenging situation. And I continue to look for information. If you get any sources that you think are reliable, please continue to send them this way. We're having as I said before, when you go through a period like the full firewalking, what happens is different constituent groups are politicking for their point of view, and they're putting forward solutions for what they need or solutions for what their system needs. And because of the intense competition in a milieu of the one we have, you get just an outpouring of ideas which are clueless, deceptive, perverse, sleazy. I could go on and on. And one of the things I want to do with the Solera Report is to help you build immunity to bad ideas. So I want to go over some of the more clever ones and the more dangerous ones this week, and just give you a little thought on what's really going on here. An editorial from Knight Kiplinger, who in fact is somebody I have great respect for, proposing that we mandate 401ks for everyone in the United States. This is a way for making the broad population save enough money to finance the Treasury and cycle more money into the Treasury just when the Treasury has to cycle more money out to our Social Security and Medicare. If you look at countries that are very financially sound in their organization and management, so if you take a look at Chile with its nationally mandated pension fund and balanced budget and rainy day fund, you're looking at a country that makes a lot of sense financially. So the idea of everybody having a 401k and being mandated to save, in one sense, you can say a lot of, oh, well, that makes sense. Well, let's look at things. We had a national pension fund. It was called Social Security. It's been money. Basically, the money's been stolen. It hasn't been properly managed. We also had IRAs. They were pumped and dumped over the last decade. So I think we're looking at a system before we mandate more of the same. There needs to be a real conversation about, well, where did the money that was stolen out of the last systems go to? I should have also mentioned the money sort of skimmed out the back door in the pension funds. Where's the money stolen gone? And there's no point in putting more money in until you have integrity. And I think there are real issues at this point of integrity at the system, not to mention the leadership attacking a lot of state and local pension funds that do have integrity and using the sort of demand for integrity to, if anything, destroy their integrity. So one question is, how can we have another mandated system when all the other mandated or influenced systems have not had the integrity that we need them to do? That's number one. Number two, one of the reasons people don't save enough is because they have no income, or they don't have enough income to cover their expenses and taxes. So that's very simple. You just lower taxes. And so I think lowering taxes and reducing the stress of government on the population would help immensely, particularly those things we do in the financial capital system and in the regulatory system that basically forces small businesses and small farms out of business. And then finally, as we've seen with Obamacare, you can mandate something, but you can't get blood from a stone. And we're seeing a significant increase in unemployment and moving people from full-time jobs to part-time jobs or doing a variety of other things that cancel benefits so business can get out of the healthcare mandates. So mandating more of a burden on small business is going to be, is going to backfire in ways which I expect Obamacare will backfire. So I think it's a very good idea to get money back that was stolen, and I think it's a very good idea to ensure integrity. But people sense this, and I think, you know, they see ideas coming, and they don't see this as a productive comment. They see this as just more intervention and theft. I put up a commentary this week on the blog called The Worst Idea Going, and this really is the worst of the week. It's an idea we've seen come back again and again. It's a little bit like the gopher in Caddyshack. If you ever saw that movie, it just keeps popping up. And each time it pops up with different constituencies or a different face because they keep trying to sell it. And they keep trying to sell it looking as though it's an idea that's coming bottom up. It's not. It's coming top down. And the idea is that every person deserves a certain income. It's a human right. And essentially what this will, the way this will play out is everybody gets a check from the state. Now, as I described in the commentary, if we are going into communities and doing things which destroy the economy, and then as we make money destroying the local economy, take a small portion of that and cycle it back as stipends to the people in that community, they go from people who are in command and have power within the economic process to people who are totally dependent on the state. It means they're very easy to control. So, dreadful idea. It's kind of addressing the symptom instead of the problem and making the overall problem worse. And it truly does lead to a totalitarian state. So take a look at that if you're interested. The worst idea going. Finally, Obama, the president, proposes tying federal financial aid to colleges and universities according to school standing, which means essentially all the money will go to the rich. It means Harvard gets everything. I'm exaggerating to make a point, but it's a way of marketing. How can I say this? What's the right word? It's the way of taxing the average American and then taking the money and shipping it to help finance the children of the rich on top of everything else that's going on in education. It's another one of these outrageously bad ideas, and is one of the reasons I come back to the movie They Live is a perfect example of what's going on. Okay, let's turn to the surveillance society, because one of the common themes in much of the news over the last several weeks and continuing this week is the ongoing debate about invasive involvement of government and corporations in our digital communications and the compromise of privacy. We have an article saying, oh, the NSA was scanning 75% of phone calls. Like, that's some big revelation. It's inconceivable to me that they're not scanning and reporting 100% of phone conversations. A story from Common Dreams, let me read it. It's up on the blog. Amid ongoing controversy over NSA warrantless spying programs, another legal battle exposes the Obama administration's willingness to steamroll civil liberties in the name of security. Last week, the Obama administration urged the U.S. Supreme Court to issue a precedent-setting ruling that the Fourth Amendment, which prohibits unreasonable and warrantless searches and seizures, somehow allows for warrantless searches of personal cell phones, the Washington Post reports. Okay, well, this has been going on for a long time. And as one subscriber said this week, well, if they've been doing this all along, why do they care to make it legal now? Well, the challenge is if you're in an environment in Washington where you have very, very even violent competition over various political decisions and appointments, you can certainly understand why the people being asked to implement these policies would prefer for them to be lawful, because otherwise, if they're technically against the law, then it's very easy for their competition to play games with them, criminal investigations, etc. So it creates great insecurity if everybody's being called on to implement illegal policies, particularly if the American people are now cognizant that they're illegal. Anyway, what's come out in this with different discussions of people who are great allies or subscribers over the last week is hearing more and more people not able to fathom the operational capacity exists to scan and digest all the digital communications of 300 plus million people. And I assure you that it does. Let me read an email I wrote to one person, one skeptic this week. They can absolutely scan and digest the emails and phone conversations of 300 million people. They've been working since the 1980s to build this using keywords, clusters, neural networks, patterns. The computation power allows them to build data on each of 300 million people and relate that to the marketing and emailing they are those people are receiving online, including subliminal messages. This has grown very advanced. They have the transaction and financial flows in every place tracked and patterned. Think of an entire digital infrastructure that parallels the real world. They can map and aggregate global conversations for insight into the psychic storm. They can collect it, they can process it, they can use it to feedback in short periods at the individual and household level, they can use it to trade. So the piece do they piece out early adapters in places and sectors? For sure. So they do not listen to everyone equally. Watch The Truman Show. It's not just a movie. Watch The Listening. Watch Enemy of the State. And these are based on more than a decade ago. And as I said, our problem is not NSA. It's AT&T, IBM. Worth rereading. And then I point to my article, The Data Beast. This is the primary machine at the heart of managing the slow burn, because they can listen and respond at the individual level to 300 million people. The cell phone tower system is first and foremost a mind control system. I strongly recommend that you educate yourself about this again and again. The reason you think the market will assert itself and I don't is because the litigation permitted me a personal and intimate education on how the surveillance machine works and feeds back into the financial and economic control system. I know you cannot fathom that this exists, but it does. Anyway, so I want you to, it really pays to understand where the technology is and how it applies to you. And I do want to point you back to several Saleri reports. If you haven't listened to the one on Adam Trombley and I do talk about entrainment technology, I think this is critical because, again, you know, your message, your emails and your phones can be scanned by artificial intelligence, and literally the machine can trigger different entrainment and subliminal programming that will then affect what you buy, how you behave, what you think. If you understand that this machinery exists, then you can protect yourself from it. So take a look or listen to the Adam Trombley interview on entrainment technology. Catherine Albrecht has been on the Saleri Report twice talking about spy chips and privacy issues. And then some great movies, The Listening and Enemy of the State, if you haven't seen them. Very entertaining, very interesting. I always said if Enemy of the State was my training movie. Interestingly enough, this summer, an article was posted talking about Enemy of the State, which was a movie that Gene Hackman and Will Smith starred in. It came out in 1998, made by British director Tony Scott, one of my favorite directors. And it portrayed the NSA as a rogue agency who kills various people, including a United States senator, in the process of trying to get something equivalent to the Patriot Act. Let me just quote the article. Former NSA Director General Michael Hayden was promoted to head the agency as the movie came out and was deeply worried about the public perception it created, James Risen reported in his 2006 book, State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration. Hayden, who went on to become the director of the CIA under President George W. Bush, was appalled by the NSA's portrayal and responded with a full-fledged PR campaign. The agency's very existence was long a state secret. Okay, so interestingly enough, Tony Scott, who was the director of Enemy of the State, was either jumped or thrown off a bridge out in California on August 2012. Completely inexplicable death. No one understands how it could have happened. And given what's now happening with surveillance, big questions. Now, on the good news side of the story, the U.S. cloud companies have emerged as defending the role of freedom and trying to get different provisions of the Patriot Act rolled back. Predictions out of Washington that some of them will be rolled back this year, more rolled back in 2015 when the Patriot Act comes up for renewal. And that's because it's very bad for business. U.S. cloud companies are now losing business in Europe, losing business globally. Nobody wants to be in a U.S. cloud company, because they don't want the NSA having access to all their stuff. So this is coming down to, money starting to line up on the side of privacy, which is a good thing. we see as part of this the marginalization of many of the people trying to do something about what's going on. This week we see Bradley Manning, who was sentenced to 35 years, announced that he wants to become a woman, that he's transsexual. We have the a brouhaha about Glenn Greenwald's partner, Brazilian fellow, being held up at the airport in London. And of course, the story goes from what Greenwald's saying about the substance to, you know, Greenwald and his relationship with his partner and his partner being detained. And then finally, Michael Hastings, who it's inconceivable to me was he died in a car accident. It's inconceivable to me that it was an accident. It looked like an assassination to me. But the coroner in California coming out and saying that Hastings had drugs in his or presence of drugs in the autopsy. So we have a complete marginalization. The story is turned into a tangent of Manning being a transsexual, Hastings being on drugs, and Greenwald, you know, his personal life as opposed to the real substance of the story. It's a perfect example of how the major media is used to turn things. And that shows you the strength of the fear on these issues and the extent to which they're trying to marginalize anybody who does anything about them. The surveillance issue is going to continue to be discussed for quite some time, because there's more and more money on the side of privacy, and the nature of the surveillance is used so extensively for economic warfare that you're going to have money on both sides of this issue, and that money's going to grow in terms of the money that's getting hurt in the economy by this kind of surveillance. Okay, another theme I want to talk to, and again, I put a commentary up on the blog, and it's about U.S. slave labor. And it relates to a discussion that's happening and changes in prison policy. Let me go back to the end of World War II. Two sort of pools of knowledge came back into the United States at the end of World War II. The first thing that happened was we recruited a significant number of Nazi leaders, particularly scientists and intelligence operatives. They were recruited to come to the United States, or they were integrated into the intelligence networks, and they were integrated into universities and businesses. And a great deal of time and money was spent to study the Nazi experience and what we could learn from it. At the same time, the group, particularly in the intelligence agencies and the military, who were in war in the Pacific, learned a great deal about how to use drugs to finance armies and occupations. And those two knowledge pools came together and synthesized into a model which has been operating very extensively and with great impact in the United States since that knowledge was sort of integrated and then put into practice. And that is the idea of using narcotics trafficking as a way of doing a leverage buyout of a place. And a lot of the train tracks for the kind of surveillance and police state that we're talking about was built around bringing narcotics into neighborhoods and then building the war on drugs. It's sort of a, if you ever remember W.C. Fields and his snake and snake oil potion, you know, one pocket he has a snake and the other he has a snake oil potion that he's selling you to protect you from the snake. And so the war on drugs and the drugs came in together, and it's been remarkable, and I've written a lot about it, so I'm not going to repeat all of that here. You can see my story, Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits or Narco Dollars for Beginners. Needless to say, this model has grown and grown and grown, and we've now ended up as the leader throughout the world with a very significant prison population. Now, it's important to understand that that prison population was not built trying to protect anybody from drugs. You know, if you follow the trail back far enough, the same people throwing everybody in prison and making money in the prisons were essentially involved in bringing in the drugs. So you have an intentional plan to do what some people would call economic cleansing, other people would call genocide. It's really a mix of both. And in the 90s, accelerated dramatically under the leadership of, among other people, Eric Holder at the Department of Justice as D.C. U.S. Attorney, and then moving up into the Department of Justice afterwards. You saw policies where literally SWAT teams were dropped into communities, rounding up innocent kids, bringing them into jail under arrest, and then cutting funding to the public defender's office so literally they couldn't get lawyers, or the lawyers were handling so many cases at once. It was the same as not having a lawyer. So we're talking about a policy that I would call, and I believe very fairly so, genocide. Now, as you brought in those young people into prison, they went into prisons where their labor was marketed to the Department of Defense by a for-profit company owned by the Department of Justice. So we're literally looking at what I would describe as the slave labor system. And I don't think there was anything in terms of slave labor that we were doing that Hitler wasn't doing. We were just doing it in a more profitable basis. Now, the interesting thing about understanding that model is if you look at the money, it wasn't just Americans who were going into prison, oftentimes innocent Americans or Americans whose crimes were relatively minor and whose punishment was quite major, but it was also the taxpayers going into prison. If you look at the Dylan Reed story, and I just had Justin make up a slide so you could see a little bit of the numbers, the slide up on the webinar software shows a list of my former partners at Dylan Reed who had financed a prison company in the 90s. And I show the profits they made in a relatively short time, financing and flipping the company stock. For example, the chairman of the firm had $750,000 profits. If you look at the number of people who had to go to prison to generate those profits, the stock market at that time was trading on a per bed basis. So think of it as a slavery system where you trade per slave. You get a certain amount of market capitalization for each person in prison. 34 people had to go to prison for a long time to generate the chairman's stock profits. But how many people had to work their entire life to pay the taxes for those 34 people? It was 340 people. If you look at the profits of all the Dylan Reed officers and directors, I estimate that 11,523 people had to work their entire life to generate the profits for those taxpayers, meaning 1,152 people had to go to jail for a pretty long time. So putting innocent or people, minor criminals, in prison for a long time and putting many, many taxpayers in prison. And so what has happened recently is I've seen more and more people start to realize that what is going on in the prison population and these policies is not just corruption. It's not just incompetence. It's not just something that got out of hand. It is a policy, and it is a policy of economic cleansing and genocide, that it is really that. I had a little discussion with Marcin Jakubowski, which I put up on the commentary I wrote on the blog about how this was so, referring him to read the Dylan Reed story. I just saw, and that transcript inspired one of the subscribers to email me and say, you've got to see this new documentary, The House I Live In, which is about the war on drugs. I put it up in the trailer up in the blog. It's worth, if you're interested in the war on drugs, it's worth watching. David Simon, the creator of The Wire, which is one of the best series that really unpacks and describes the war on drugs, marvelous, marvelous, talented director and producer. David Simon described the war on drugs as a Holocaust in slow motion. I think that's, if anything, that's an understated description. Anyway, my bet is that Holder coming out several weeks ago, as he did, and we covered this with the commentary and discussion on the Solari report, now Attorney General Holder coming out and saying we need to roll back mandatory sentences and some of these policies, That's Holder knowing that things have reached the point where too many people are starting to figure this out and starting to ask serious questions. And that puts a lot of different parts of the system in real danger. And so I think Holder is smelling the tea leaves, or certainly Holder is following the lead of being told that too many people are reading the tea leaves and are scared that the American people are going to figure out, you know, that this is not a legitimate system. There's something else going on as well. You have, coming into sequestration, you have automatic cuts, and that means you have serious budget issues. Lockheed Martin needs that money and wants that money for things related to keeping the dollar up. They have a lot more political clout than prison companies. So just as we're seeing with the cloud companies, I think there's a lot of pressure behind the scenes by people who have a lot of political and lobbying clout and can assert their rights to that money ahead of prison companies. We saw the Economist this week, the New Economist. I would say the official organ of the Anglo-American Alliance come out and say that Holder didn't go far enough. And so I think there's a real effort to backpedal here in a way that reaffirms the legitimacy of the brand and makes sure that many, many people don't finally face what this policy really was about. The new economy growth just keeps booming. So there's lots of good news in the economy. We see MakerBot come out with an announcement that their digitizer will go on sale. What that means is it's getting much easier to convert a physical object into the software plans. You need to turn around and move to your 3D printer and start to make a copy of that physical object. So we're just seeing an explosion across the board. I spent last weekend reading a very interesting report from the UK Patent Office on graphene, but it's quite, whether it's 3D printing, whether it's other fabrication technology, whether it's composite materials, whether it's robotics, the explosion of innovation is everywhere. Speaking of explosion of innovation, surprise, surprise, Germany announced that it would recognize Bitcoin, would accept Bitcoin for, I think, tax payments, a couple other payments. That kind of caught me by surprise. That's a very interesting development, particularly if it catches on with other sovereign governments. Finally, we saw NASDAQ close due to a glitch. What's that about? We had a 3-hour shutdown. Lots of stocks couldn't trade. Options shut down. Don't know what it's about. Hard to believe it's just a computer glitch. And it's the kind of thing we see happen when there's a lot of tension in the market about which way the market's going to go. So you always kind of wonder. Okay, well, our hero this week is a remarkable man. He's the former Prime Minister of British Columbia. He was the Premier of British Columbia from 86 to 91. His name is Bill van der Zom, and he has come out with a letter sent to many government officials demanding freedom of information on climate control programs, a.k.a. chemtrails, busting open chemtrails and saying, requesting that municipal councils, city councils, and regional boards pass a resolution to say, quote, no particulate matter for climate control be sprayed in the atmosphere above their jurisdiction without informed consent. This is a very courageous act and a very wonderful act. So we tip our hat to the former Premier of British Columbia, Bill van der Zom. I'd like to also mention a runner-up, Greg Palast, who is a wonderful investigative reporter who manages to get people to send him the most amazing documentation, has come up with a little article basically saying Larry Summers shouldn't be Fed chairman, Larry Summers should be in prison, and shows a letter, a memo from Tim Geithner to then Deputy Secretary Summers about the WTO financial services negotiations and industry consultations thereon. It's really a little doozy, and these are the kind of documents that Greg Palast gets and makes accessible. And, you know, I just have to say there's nothing like a great investigative reporter, and he certainly is one. Ask Catherine, one comment from a subscriber, very interesting. Let me get it for you. He says, none of the warmongers have an answer to the question, what happens when suicides exceed combat deaths? It's a good question. One subscriber wrote this week, I'm sure you know of Karen, I think her name is pronounced Hudes, H-U-D-E-S. Do you have any thoughts on her battle to expose the corruption at the World Bank? Does she truly have access to break the banking cabal? Thanks for your time. In response to, do you have any thoughts on her battle to expose the corruption? I wrote back, no. I reviewed several of her interviews and materials and concluded she was not someone I would recommend to subscribers or invite to interview. And in response, does she truly have the means to break the banking cabal? I said, no. I got one question for Colonel Wilkerson after I interviewed him. Sorry about that, Brad. And then a question from Jim Gallup, from San Diego. The original bailout we were all sold here in the U.S., the Congress had to approve, was for $700 billion. But you pointed out that the total amount of the bailouts had exceeded $27 trillion, with, I believe, no additional congressional approval for this amount having been necessary. Did the original bailout legislation provide for the people we're really running things to be able to increase the bailouts by unlimited amounts without ever having to face any liability for doing so? They contributed, but it was a combination of many different laws, regulations, and essentially lawlessness. So I would say no, it wasn't sufficient in and of itself. It was a combination of many things. There are so many individuals out there giving us the impression that they're all fighting for our rights and our freedom as individuals, and they have internet audiences who follow them. How do we know who's really legitimate within this area and who's really just covertly working to misguide us on behalf of the powers that be? I would say, by their fruits shall you know them. So first of all, do they understand how things really work? Are they presenting, or are they presenting a fashionable presentation of what is? So I think, you know, you be the judge of that, but I found most people have the ability to judge that. That's number one. Number two, you want to understand how their money works. Who finances them? Are they self-supporting with broadly diversified revenues from just individuals supporting them, or are they getting money from the Ford Foundation? Who's financing them? And then what are their results? And not just what are the results in one situation, but what are the results over many, many, many periods? And I think it's important to also understand that one person can do a piece, but they can't do everything. So, you know, never criticize somebody because they contributed strongly on one issue and did nothing on the other. They can't do everything, especially given the fact that we're not willing to supply them with trillions of dollars or billions of dollars of revenue. So everybody has to work within the budget that can, you know, that can practically support them. Finally, do they provide sufficient information for you to make up your mind for yourself? So what I always try and do is, you know, I'm happy to give you my opinion. That's what I do on the Solari Report. But I try and make sure you get links and documentation and other things up on the blog so that you're free to go make your mind up for yourself. And I think we each have to take responsibility for what we know and believe. And then finally, I would say, who are their allies? Who recommends them? I find that the really excellent people over time prove themselves out with many people, and you can tell a lot by the, you know, by the slow and steady support and networking with lots of other people who are trustworthy. And as I said, everybody can only do a piece, so everybody does their piece. Nobody's perfect, and we each have to be responsible ultimately for what we believe and what we support. But I do think if you follow those methods, you'll get a pretty good sense. And I'm always happy, you know, on the Solari Report, if you have a question about an individual person, I'm happy to try and give you my opinion. Interview. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. The interview's posted up on the blog. I can't recommend it enough. It's a very wide-ranging interview. I asked Colonel Wilkerson to sit in the position of the Joint Chiefs and say, what are the most important issues facing the U.S. military? I had emailed him on this topic about 6 months ago and gave him my list of what I guess the issues were. And interestingly enough, he came back with a somewhat different list, and he included the suicide and sex abuse. I hadn't. It's one I want to talk about in the Let's Go to the Movies section. And what you'll see, what I think emerged from the conversation, is that the biggest challenge is what I talked about at the beginning of tonight's Salieri Report. How in the world do you build a strong military leadership in a world where the governmental structure and the financial system are increasingly corrupt and politicized? How do you build strong morale? How do you build discipline? How do you bring up the chain of command, leaders who are excellent at performing in their military positions? A big one I saw when the little I've worked with the military is, how in the world can you organize your investment of time and resources in things that optimize military performance as opposed to optimize profits for defense contractors? That's a real big one. And right now, we do not have a governance process which holds the investment through the budget accountable to performance. The pull of different constituencies for that money is great, and the dependency of the stock market and the bond market and the derivative markets is dependent. And on one side, you have the short-term interests of, say, a defense contractor's trade a certain way, or you need this kind of money to keep this part of the bond market up. On the other hand, you know, if the military doesn't perform excellently, I assure you the whole house of cards can come down. So there are tremendous tensions playing out through the budget as we go into this and the rounds of budget in 2014 and 2015. And at the heart, in the center of that war, is what's going to happen and what's the quality of U.S. military leadership. And I assure you that is germane to the value of your CDs, the value of the dollar bills you hold in your pocket, the value, you know, of many of your financial assets. And we can like that or not, but that's the reality. So I really encourage you to listen. Okay, let's go to the movies. The movie I chose was The Invisible War. It's a 2012 documentary about sex abuse in the U.S. military. It's reasonably good in terms of describing the men and women who've experienced that abuse. And it's not just the sexual abuse itself. It's then the abuse dealing with the military justice and healthcare systems. The Invisible War focuses more on the victim. And it doesn't take us into a full look of why this is happening and what can be done. I think it's a much more complex problem than is described. That's quite a serious topic and a long one for a documentary to take on. So I do think it's not a full picture of the whole story. But it does bring up a very important question, and that is for many, right now, the U.S. military is one of the most respected institutions in America today, and the American people have long been the lifeblood of the U.S. military, supplying, obviously, soldiers and all sorts of support in a variety of ways in terms of personnel, and I hadn't really understood the importance of the I'd understood the importance of suicides, but not of the sexual abuse. And one of our producers, when Colonel Wilkerson put it on the list, said to me, "No, this is very, very serious." She said, because the feedback that is coming from people who are coming back from the military and coming back into their families is, there's great anger and sense of betrayal. And this has the ability to really destroy the support of the population for the military, particularly in areas that have traditionally supplied a very high percentage. I live in the Southeast, and the Southeast has always provided a great number of personnel to the U.S. military. And so I hadn't realized the seriousness of what is happening. And it was our producer and Colonel Wilkerson who suggested I take a deeper look. So I think there is a serious problem, and we've seen a lot of announcements by the military over the last 4 to 6 weeks as they struggle with this. And it's a very interesting part of the conversation. But anyway, lively interview. I can't recommend it enough. Okay, that's it for closing. We have John Rappaport, a very interesting interview coming up next week, August 29th, and then September 5th, I'm going to be talking about what is breakthrough energy with Joel Garbon, who's the president of the New Energy Movement, and Jeroen van Straten, who was the very talented entrepreneur from Holland, from Amsterdam, who organized the Global Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference in Holland, and it's doing the same for the one in Boulder this year. And so we wanted to have that in anticipation of the conference in the second week of October in Colorado. Then September 12th with Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders. So until I'm with you for September 5th for What is Breakthrough Energy, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. There certainly is one that's throwing us off the telephone. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck. Well, it's my pleasure to welcome to the Soleri Report Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. This is the second time that Colonel Wilkerson has joined us on the Soleri Report. If you go back into the archive, you'll hear a great discussion on national security in May 2011. Today he joins us. I have been looking for someone to give us an overview from the point of view of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. What are the strategic issues facing the U.S. military? And after much research, I confirmed that indeed Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson is the best person to do that. He has served with distinction in the United States Army, and after retiring from the U.S. Army, served as Chief of Staff to then Secretary of State Colin Powell, and since has become a professor. He's teaching national security at the College of William and Mary, and prior to that time lectured at George Washington University. So without further ado, Colonel Wilkerson, welcome to the Soleri Report.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, I'm going to ask you what the most important strategic issues are, but of course, first, I should probably say that, you know, you don't usually do this, but you do get to say, you told us so.
I usually try to refrain from doing that.
No, you don't have to do that. I'll do that. So why don't you take us through? Let's just start. Let's give us an overview of your list of the most important. But I would like to dive in and talk about sort of the wind down of the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, and get from you the point of view of you warned us not to go about it in this manner. So why don't I turn it over to you?
I would, you know, if I were walking into the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff office today the way I used to walk into Powell's office in the early 90s, and sit down and really talk substantively about the problems confronting the armed forces, and Powell was very good about allowing that to happen. We didn't always deal with them, but we talked about them. I'd put them in sort of three categories today. I'd say there are some immediate, potentially disastrous, even soul-destroying problems. And these are things like suicides, sexual assault, which is just off the charts, religious freedom in the ranks and the dominionist in the ranks, the group that's trying to take over the armed forces. I know that sounds preposterous, but just Google dominionist and you'll see what their agenda is. Getting more tactical, the withdrawal from Afghanistan, which is going to cost at least $40 billion and is going to be extremely difficult. The potential for reentry into Iraq and war in Syria or with Iran or with both. And then those are the immediate, potentially disastrous problems, both professional and tactical slash strategic. Then there's another category that I would say are future problems, several of which have the immediacy of today in terms, if we don't start to react, or maybe we should have reacted yesterday, they could loom large tomorrow morning. And Chuck Hagel, Secretary of Defense, has kind of summed this up in what he calls his strategic review, though I'm not sanguine about what's going to be the result of it. Looks more and more like a typical review rather than a real substantive review. I would also place in this deciding whether we're going to do a more or less offshore balancing strategy, which means basically naval forces, or are we going to do an in-your-face confrontation, which means land forces on the ground all around the world? Size and balance and nature of the armed forces, the nature of the military contractors who are becoming increasingly monopolistic who support them, the fact there's no creative thinking in the military right now, and so forth. And then there's a third category. Defining the threats to U.S. security. What are they? And in this strained economic time, how much risk are you willing to accept in building the capabilities in your armed forces necessary to confront those threats successfully? Risk being defined as the gap between your assessment of the threat and your economic capability to build the tools you need to address that threat. That gap becomes risk, of course. So those are the areas that I would say really plague us, Mr. Chairman, or Mrs. Chairman. Someday we'll have one. And I would want to talk about those things with the chairman because I think they're serious. In fact, in 1989, 1991, we were dealing with Mikhail Gorbachev, the dissolution of the Soviet Union, all that that meant, a 29%, and then finally with Clinton coming in, almost a 35% reduction in the Cold War armed forces and in the budget and so forth. I would say these times right now are far more serious than those times.
Right, I agree. Well, take us back. How did we end up bogged down in a land war in the Middle East? How did that, you know, why did we do it, and how do we pull back?
If I were looking back on it right now, I'd say, Mr. Chairman or Mrs. Chairman, we should have beaten the heck out of Al-Qaeda, given the Taliban a bloody nose and left. That would have taken about a year and probably about $1.5 trillion less and probably some 1,500 to even 2,000, which is the total right now, casualties less. Had anything resumed in the way of danger to the United States, we could have gone back and done it again. Instead, we stayed there and chose to nation build. Wrong country to do that in, par excellence. If right. you look at a map, you see that Afghanistan has no ports. It's surrounded. Now, one of our principal problems in withdrawing is not fighting as we leave. We might have to do that. But the principal problem is the money it's going to cost us as we have to pay those around across whose territory we need to retreat, whether it's right. Pakistan, Uzbekistan, Iran, wherever we go to get out of Afghanistan, to haul this some $40 billion worth of equipment and other things, is going to charge us an arm and a leg because they know we're trapped. If I were looking at it today and I were strictly a military strategist, I would say don't ever get involved in that country. Terrible place to be. Compound that with the fact we have an illegitimate government. We still have massive sanctuary for the enemies that we're fighting there. That sanctuary is supported majorly by the Pakistani ISI, the intelligence services, because they want the Taliban to remain robust in Afghanistan as a counter to India. And we have more or less no way to say we've done anything really with regard to our major emphasis on nation building because there isn't a nation there. So if you want to look at an article that really describes all of this, there's a LA Times piece that came out actually 13 August this week by an Army colonel, and this must be a pseudonym. It's got to be a pseudonym because he's still active duty. The pseudonym is Gian Gentile, and the title is America's Nation Building at Gunpoint. What a title. You don't build nations at gunpoint. And we failed in Iraq and we failed in Afghanistan. Look at Iraq today. My prediction would be the civil war is going to get increasingly worse. Saudi Arabia will support the Sunnis with infinite money, and soon the Sunnis will resume power in Baghdad. And we'll probably have a truncated Iraq. We'll have a Kurdistan in the north, a Sunni-dominated enclave in the center, including Baghdad, and perhaps an Iranian-dominated area around Basra in the south. What an outcome.
And what about Syria?
That is probably the potential great catastrophe in Western Asia right now. You've got Russia involved. You've got China involved. You've got Turkey involved. You've got Iran majorly involved. You've got the United States becoming increasingly more involved. Huge amounts of dollars going in there. You've got Israel involved. This could be, I know people shudder when I say this, but this could be the Archduke Ferdinand of 1914. We could ignite a spark in Syria that reaches into almost all of Western Asia and even out to Beijing and up to Moscow and certainly down to Tehran, and causes a regional, if not a global, conflict to erupt, one that would look very different from past conflicts like World War II
right.
and so forth. It would include economic warfare, political warfare, cyber warfare, we call it. There are dimensions to it that could quickly get out of hand, and we could wind up in a 30-year struggle.
And then finally, Iran. Over the last couple of years, suddenly the pressure is on to go to war with Iran. And to me, it's inconceivable that you expand what's going on in the Middle East. And then it comes down and it's back and forth. What is the situation with Iran? I mean, what we seem to see is the leadership in Iran, sending olive branches, but
I think
who knows?
I'm guardedly optimistic on the Iranian side. We do have someone now, President Rouhani, with whom and his appointees, with whom we probably can deal. But on the Washington side, and I'm not totally forgiving of Tehran, I mean, their obduracy and intransigence matches Washington letter for letter usually. But on the Washington side, I don't see the political and moral courage on the part of the president to defy what has become an almost unanimous attitude in the legislature, the Congress, about Iran and sanctions and so forth, making our diplomacy really equivalent to sanctions, and sanctions equals diplomacy. So unless we're willing to offer some substantial sanctions relief in exchange for the things we want from Iran, such as to cease enhancing or enriching uranium above 5%, to come clean on their previous program to the IAEA in regards to any nuclear weapons program they might have had, and we're pretty sure they did have something. We're also pretty sure
right.
they've stopped it. And taking the uranium they have enhanced above 5% and either using it under IAEA safeguards or getting rid of it and guaranteeing the international community they won't enhance above 5% anymore, while the U.S. recognizes their right to exist as a nation with all the responsibilities and privileges appertaining thereto, and expresses that its intent, its strategic intent vis-a-vis Iran is not regime change, which is what the Iranians think. That's a huge plate to deal with, bilaterally or in the permanent 5+1, Germany. Either way, either venue is a very difficult one to those issues to deal with. And then you throw on top of that Afghanistan, Iraq, terrorism, and so forth, all of which you need Iran to come to any kind of stability. And Afghanistan will never be stable without Iran. Iraq
right.
will never be stable without Iran. So it's a hugely important time, and as you said, maybe opportunistic for diplomacy, and yet, as I said, I'm very cynical about whether or not Washington's going to be able to muster the kind of political courage, moral courage it needs to make the diplomacy work.
Well, it seems like the great powers are committed to bringing incoherence to the Middle East.
You say that there is a group of people, and I know some
uh-huh.
of them, who
yeah.
for whom that's their strategy.
Yes,
they,
I agree.
They
completely.
believe that if you separate Iraq, that is to say, if you got three little Iraqs, it's not as bad as one big one. If you let Syria dissolve itself into chaos, Lebanon will follow. Egypt is already looking as if it's going to follow. If you get chaos all around that little enclave of stability called Israel, then not only do you preserve Israel's security, but you make your job a whole lot easier because you divide and conquer. I personally think, from my study of history and my experience of 31 years in the military, that that is a preposterous theory. But it is one that many people, some of them with great wealth, maintain.
Right. If you look at the Charlie Ferguson's documentary on Iraq, and you were interviewed, I think, extensively for it, what you really do see is an intentional effort to bring incoherence.
It is a theory. It is a strategic theory. It has some lineage back in history.
Right.
People like Charlemagne, the Genghis Khan, Alexander the Great from time to time, divide
right.
and conquer was a theory. I just don't believe with the volatility of today's issues and the price of oil and the free flow of oil, particularly through the Strait, and all the economic and financial dimensions thereof, and all the people you could pull into this, as I mentioned earlier, I think you're really playing with fire when you advance and try to pursue a theory like that.
Now, if you were Iran, wouldn't you, with the Israelis having nuclear weapons, wouldn't you want nuclear weapons?
Pakistan has nuclear weapons. India has nuclear weapons. As you said, Israel has nuclear weapons, and by the way, is not in the NPT and is not responsible to the IAEA. Yes, the simple answer to that question is yes, I would, and I see no, right down to the brass tacks, I see no problem were Iran to have a nuclear weapon. In fact, I think it would be probably a balancing effect rather than a disastrous, disturbing effect. But I think we've made it, foreign policy, national security-wise, we've made it so clear now that, that it's unacceptable to use the government's language, that if we back down, we're sitting there looking as if we can't enforce anything that we want to, particularly in that region of the world where our power has been remarkably diminished, and ironically enough, by our own actions, such as the invasion of Iraq.
So let's turn to what you described as Secretary Hagel's sort of strategic issues. What I'm watching as a financial person is that every year for the last 20 years, the power of the reserve currency depends ever more on the military. So it's almost as though the military's scope of work from a financial point of view continues to get more and more important. And that begs the question, how in the world do you achieve that? You know, how do you achieve that global force when you are facing budget cuts and, you know, all sorts of complexities? You know, you're facing a world where you're not just dealing with sovereign states, but relatively small groups can get very powerful weapons. So, you know, your global reach is being required to be greater and greater, whereas your resources are getting spread thinner and thinner. So what do you do?
Well, the first thing I think you have to do, as I said earlier, is you have to identify what are the really serious threats. It's befuddling to me to sit back and consider what Powell and I, for example, used to look at in the Soviet Union, some 28 to 30,000 nuclear weapons, many of which were on missiles that could reach us from a Yankee submarine off Washington, for example, in 8 to 16 seconds, others certainly in 30 minutes to an hour, and we all knew would, Dr. Strangelove notwithstanding, we all knew would probably wipe out the United States in terms of 100 years. It certainly would end our lifestyle.
Right.
Existential threat, we like to call it. And then today, to think what we're doing with regard to an attack from Al-Qaeda that kills some Americans, fewer Americans, I might add, than are killed on the highways in a single year in this country. And now we have spent trillions of dollars, are going to spend trillions more, under the AUMF, the Authorization for the Use of Military Force. We are still at war, and there is no end to that war in sight. Guantanamo is a perfect example of that. How did we get here? How did we get to the point where our assessment of the risk focuses on these tiny little groups around the world whose capability to really do harm to us is minimal, especially compared to the previous confrontation we had with the Soviets and with communism? How did we get there? We need to reevaluate that swiftly, because there are some genuine growing threats in the world that we need to take care of. And with this diversion of our assets to what Powell has very eloquently, I think, called the military-industrial terrorist complex, then we don't have those assets for the threats that might really be existential or formidable in the future. So that's the first thing we need to do, is to sit down and really say, why are we doing this? Why are we spending
all this money? Well, I always just assumed that the war on terrorism was an excuse to, you know, for the military industrial group to go global and reassert all sorts of command of resources.
I think there's no question that that's an impulse, and that's a motivation, and certainly an influence, whether you're talking about Lockheed Martin or Halliburton or whatever. But I think there's also a political exploitation of what I would call the politics of fear. Go back to Joseph McCarthy and the House Un-American Activities Committee, Jenner, the senator who really was more formidable than McCarthy in the shadows. and you see what I'm talking about, you can really get the American people, or at least a significant majority of them, worked up, get them scared, and you can spend all kinds of money in their name, in the name of national security. I think that's why we have this draconian surveillance state right now. People have jumped into that. I'll name them. People like Michael Hayden, who's making a fortune off of it, former DNI. We got people who are plugged into this community now and are making a lot of money off keeping the American people scared about this threat. But we've got to wake up, our legislators in particular, in the White House.
Right, there are real threats out there.
Yeah, but there's some real threats out there.
Right.
Some of those threats are not that coherent right now, and that very incoherence, that very chaos, if you will, in itself constitutes a threat. That really comes into play, and I'm no expert on this, due diligence here, but that really comes into play, I think, when we talk about this kind of in economic financial warfare, which I saw just little pieces of in a tiny cell in the NSA when I was at the State Department, which I can't talk about because it was highly classified. But when I saw what those people could do, it was awesome.
Right.
And then you realize that others can do it, like Paris and Berlin and Beijing and Moscow. And it becomes very scary, and I'm not sure we're doing that much about that. We're just kind of frolicking down the lane thinking everything will be okay.
Well, it's interesting. What you're watching, and I watch this because I work day-to-day as an investment advisor, so you're watching warfare move from land war to economic war to digital war, and the challenge for most investors is, you know, it's no longer a financial market or a place to invest in financial assets. You're in the middle of a battle zone, or you're just trying to use your phone and internet systems, and it's a battle zone.
Well, you're
and
right.
So,
I put it sometimes this way when we would have strategic conversations back in the early 90s. When you look at what the threats are and what their potential might be in the future, and you assess risk, your biggest factor, first of all, you have to be very careful, just like I know you know this with financial markets, Alan Greenspan, Larry Summers, Bob Rubin, all those guys, they kind of became, they discounted uncertainty. Well, you can never, never discount uncertainty.
Right.
John Maynard Keynes would say it's probably the most prominent feature in the world in any walk of life. And it certainly is in threat assessment, capability building, force planning, and so forth. So that's the real huge factor that increases risk exponentially, instantaneously sometimes. And that takes creativity to deal with, entrepreneurship, you might call it. And I don't see that. You know, Bernard Shaw had a play, Joan of Arc, where he has the Archbishop of Canterbury say, must the Christ die in every generation to save those with no imagination? Wow, what a statement. Well, we simply don't seem to have any imagination. The Pentagon.
Well, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
My experience, which was a long time ago, but it certainly looks the same, is if you're the Joint Chiefs or you're leading the leadership, you have a problem, and that is a great deal of your infrastructure is much more focused on what makes their stock go up or their corporate, you know, profits and bonuses go up than they are on what optimizes the national security interest and the overall economy.
You're absolutely right.
So the
very first thing, you've heard me say this before, I know, but the very first thing that Hagel should have done, and I worked for his confirmation, I know Chuck Hagel fairly well, I've known him for a long time, he's a good man, but the first thing he should have done was said to the Congress, you are organized wrongly, and we need to change that organization, and oh, by the way, I'm going to match it with change in the Pentagon. We need to look at national security from a holistic point of view. We need to look at it from the point of view of everything we spend money on. In 2010, for example, fiscal 2010, we spent about, not what we professed we spent on defense, we spent about $1.2, $1.3 trillion, 6, 7, even 8% of gross domestic product. That's a hell of an expenditure, but you have to put it all together. You put intelligence, with Veterans Affairs, with Homeland Security, with the 150 International Relations account at the State Department, with the Defense Department, and with that humongous intelligence budget, which I think now, if the truth were told, was over $100 billion annually. And ask yourself, open parentheses, ask yourself, what are we getting for it, close parentheses.
As a person following mortgage fraud, I have to tell you, I think your estimate is low.
Well, I mean, this is incredible, and we're not looking at it from that national security point of view. We're looking at it in stovepipes, and as you pointed out, there are lots and lots of people who are making enormous amounts of money off those stovepipes and off the slop right. in between them. We need right. to stop that.
Well, I don't know. You're talking about a financial revolution, because what I've seen, you know, I haven't sat with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, but what I've seen is very senior, excellent line military who was not free to even think creatively in the invention room because something they say may, you know, may cut the contracts for contractor X or cut the purchase of big equipment from weapons maker Y, and they can't even, you know, you feel nothing but fear from them. And, you know, part of that is simply the fear of keeping the stock market up. So, you know, part of it is, I wouldn't say it's legitimate, but it's not necessarily, you know, just one guy making money. They are concerned about the overall presentation of the economics, but you literally have people who are not allowed to be creative because everything is about this, you know, magical increase in the profits for the corporate infrastructure that the whole thing is financing.
And what you've just pointed out in one fashion or another, depending on the context and the times, is one of the attributes of empire when it's in its final days, which is worrying, troubling. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Is it possible for a variety of leadership from many different, you know, parts of the leadership equation to get together and say, okay, we need a process that allows the military, at least at the top, to be able to creatively perform? In other words, you know, we've been able to get away with allocating the resources, for corporate performance instead of military performance. Is there a way to bring it back into balance? Is there a way to bring it back into alignment? We need a process that can allow that to happen, if it's only just to go to the invention room.
I don't disagree with you, and I would say the first ingredient you need is leadership. And I would point out that what I teach is national security decision-making from World War II. So I look at all the presidents from Harry Truman through Dwight Eisenhower, John Kennedy, Richard Nixon, all the way up to the current occupant of the White House. And I'm stunned sometimes how I see in that progression of leaders really only two or three who are very good. It's not because they're not good leaders in and of themselves before they come to the White House or even good managers. It's because this is an increasingly more complex and monumental challenge. And so
right.
where do you find people who are capable of meeting this kind of challenge, not being entrapped by the John Brennans, the Michael Haydens, the George Tenets, and the host of other ministers and truth tellers that come into the Oval Office and capture them immediately, especially with regard
right.
to national security? You need an Eisenhower. You need someone who is so experienced, so talented, that he can say, I don't want to spend a penny more on defense than I need to, and then turn to the Pentagon
right.
for 8 years, stiff them until they come up with something that works.
He was rolling his eyes by the time he left.
Oh, yes.
If
Susan is right, and I've no reason to doubt her, she said, I think I'm quoting her almost verbatim, he said one day, God help the United States of America if anybody ever sits in this chair who doesn't understand the military the way I do.
Right.
Prescient words.
There's a great story where one of the private contractors, while he was president, tried to persuade them to let them own, you know, build and own nuclear weapons. And you could just see him rolling his eyes like, these people are nuts. Anyway, so let's turn to some of the domestic issues. I don't know if you saw it, but there's a recent survey by Pew that published that showed the military as the most respected profession in the country. The military was, it's up on my blog, it's Hillary.com. The military is up at the top, and lawyers, not surprisingly, are at the very bottom.
I'm surprised Congress didn't beat them out, beat the lawyers out.
I have to go back and look. Congress was very, somewhere in there, it was very low.
Last time I saw, they had a 9% rating.
When I say the list of strategic issues, I didn't include sexual abuse in the ranks, and then you included it back in your list, and we had a wonderful young producer who's from the Nashville area, and she said to me, no, this is really serious. You've got to look at this. So I've spent some time...
Yeah, it's extremely serious. I just finished reading a manuscript by Sarah Bloom. It's called Women Under Fire, Abuse in the Military. It's coming out in November. And over 200 cases documented, and they're just gut-wrenching.
Right.
I don't know if you listened to Jennifer Stevens at all, very articulate young lady. There was a Business Insider piece on 2 August in their military and defense section by Brian Jones. Female soldier brilliantly calls out military for blaming victims, and that's what they've been doing, blaming the victims. There's no leadership. She said something that echoed my own thought. She said, if I hear zero tolerance one more time, I'll puke. Zero tolerance. That's what the chairman says. That's what General Odierno says in the Army. That's what everyone says in the leadership. Zero tolerance, my rear end. In 2012, there were 26,000 assaults by DOD's own records, and only 3% resulted in any kind of punishment.
Right.
It's epidemic.
I just finished watching a documentary. I was looking for something on this called The Invisible War. I don't know if you've seen it, but here's why I realized how I hadn't realized how rampant it was and how sort of the military has tried to sort of ignore it. But the other thing is, you know, I live and you live in the South, and the South provides an extraordinary number of young and very talented young people to the military, and the military is a very respected profession in this culture, and, you know, the military depends on that, you know, on that whole population sending the best and the brightest of their young people, or some of them. And what I realized listening to our producer was, wait a minute, you know, this could destroy that relationship. This could destroy the, you know, the trust that the U.S. population, particularly the ones who send their kids, could have in the military.
And, I think you're right.
Yeah.
It also destroys the most important bond amongst soldiers, male or female, in the foxhole, and that's their willingness to die and to be wounded and to fight for one another. It's not mom and apple pie in the foxhole. It's not even patriotism in the foxhole. It's your buddies. That's the real cohesive force. And what happens when your buddy rapes you? I mean, you destroy that bond. By the way, 11%, DOD figures again, 11% of the sexual assaults are male on male.
Well, it's not, I think the problem is not just when your buddy rapes you, it's when you try and do something about it. So let's say the buddy who raped you is your commander. You try and get, you know, transferred so that you can get away from the rapist. And no one will help you, and no one will do anything, and then you proceed to get raped in the process again. So the hierarchy, as you try and do something about this or get help for medical attention or whatever, you know, you get raped again, and it's often that second rape, which is the biggest problem in terms of destroying, because then you've got the person, you know, the person who was raped is destroyed, but then you've got a whole bunch of their colleagues and fellow soldiers who see that rape and then stop trusting the hierarchy.
Right.
And then
right.
You've got a real breakdown.
It's terribly damaging. I've called it soul destroying, and I think it is. It just wreaks havoc throughout the ranks.
Well, why is it the military is not able to come up with a way to effectively deal with this?
I heard one of the leaders who should have known better the other day say in a moment of offhand candor that he probably regretted afterwards, well, it's just the youth culture of today. I think what we saw in Afghanistan which is increasingly coming to drive young people out of the military, captains and E5s and E6s, sergeants and staff sergeants, is this huge, you might call it a generation gap, but it's got to be multiple generations in my view, between the young, creative, entrepreneurial, hard-charging officers and NCOs and ultimately troops in the military, particularly the Army and Marine Corps, and its leadership. Its leadership is sycophantic. Its leadership doesn't think strategically, let alone creatively. Its leadership has come up through the ranks, and Powell and I saw this every day, making sure it didn't get into trouble, making sure that it met all the requirements as it went along the way, kissing ass and taking names and all the things that everybody knows right. how to do. And when it gets to the top, as Little Art said, it forgets what leadership is all about, if it ever knew. So we've got a real strange group of flag officers in the military today. I'm not trying to brand them all, but many of them right. are incapable of taking serious action. They just don't know how, and they're also a part of the old boy group. I'm sure I don't know this
well, they're
guy.
Not,
who,
they're not principals. They're poodles.
Oh, yeah, you know. Yeah. And you get
yeah,
this.
Yeah, I call them attack poodles.
And what's going to happen, and Jennifer Stevens, the young lady I was talking to you about, she's really pushing for this right now, and I'm not sure I'm not for her, is the Congress is eventually under pressure going to take that part of the Uniform Code of Military Justice away from the military and give it to a civilian body so that civilian body can be autonomous,
you know, something
that
is,
independent.
That is so frightening to me.
Well, if they won't do anything, when you have things like a convening authority, I believe it was in Italy, where you had a clear case of an officer having sexually assaulted not one but several, and you had a conviction in the lower courts, and then the convening authority, the general who is the supervisor right. of that system, who reverses everything and lets the guy go. I mean, if I were in the Congress on one of the Armed Services Committees, I'd probably be asking some pretty serious questions right now. Do we need to take this away?
What you're doing is you're creating a matrix structure on the line from top to bottom between the military and the civilian authorities, and the civilian authorities are just as corrupt and misusing it. And so,
I don't disagree with that. But I do think it's almost like the checks and balances systems that our
right.
founders set up. You know, you let someone else's evil check someone else's evil. And
right.
you're
right.
never going to get that checked inside. It's sort of like President Obama coming out the other day and saying he was going to have a searching review of the surveillance program. Well, I mean, my God, in another venue, he condemned Edward Snowden. Edward Snowden is the man who made him say that.
Right.
And in the process of doing this, what does he do? He turns to the guy who's in charge of everything, Clapper, the guy who lied to the Congress of the United States and hasn't been punished for it, and says, investigate yourself, come and tell me what you find. You need something on the outside to do that. And I know what's on the outside is probably going to be corrupt too, but at least it's going to have
right.
an interest, a competitive interest, if nothing else, in
right.
trying to, you know, show the other side up. I don't know how
right.
you fix this otherwise, and I'm increasingly coming to believe we're going to need some kind of civilian body. This has happened before. It's happened in other areas. The Congress,
yeah.
after all, by the Constitution, is responsible for the armed forces of the United States. Actually, the Congress, it's forgotten this in many respects, is more responsible for them than the Commander-in-Chief is.
Right. Right. No, that's true. Well, let's just turn now to taking care of the U.S. veterans, because one of the results of the war in Afghanistan and Iraq is we have a significant number of veterans coming back who need to be integrated in, including a significant number of disabled veterans. And that, you know, that is a, I don't know, it's sort of a pig going through the snake of the society. And it doesn't seem to me that we're doing a very good job of it. So maybe if you could comment on that.
On the one hand, I'm really happy with some of the things that are going on. I just participated in a program called Project Healing Waters. It's where we take badly wounded vets and teach them how to fly fish. And
mm-hmm.
you've not had your heart warm until you stand in a river and watch a young man standing there with no legs on his prosthetic devices, fishing for a trout and not even thinking about anything but catching that trout. you watch the therapeutic effect on him and so forth. This didn't happen after my war, Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Not really, not across the country like it's happening now. So private citizens and private groups have stepped up to do a lot of things for veterans.
Right. There's a lot of great groups doing a lot of things. That's
tremendous.
True.
But you, back to your point, the official response is underfunded, massively underfunded, and doesn't look like it's going to ever get the right monies. And it's not very well orchestrated out of the VA department. And you've got 900,000 cases in backlog. I recently met with some veterans and heard their horror stories. One young sergeant, clearly badly wounded, they took 625 days. 625 days to process his first claim. Another young lady, tremendously impacted, intelligence official who had been tremendously impacted by post-traumatic stress, something like 900 days. That's 3 years before they did anything with her request. The backlog is humongous. So the official response has been anything but terrific. The private response has been tremendous. That said, I was just in Oklahoma City. I met the mayor and some other people, talked to the Rotary, and went out to Oklahoma University and so forth. And I'm sitting at a dinner the first night with what turns out to be on my right, the Secretary of Military and Veterans Affairs, a retired Army two-star. And she turns to me and she says, "You know who's populating our prisons in the greatest percentage now?" And stuns me and says, "Veterans." Veterans. She says, "Our prisons are overflowing." By the way, Oklahoma provides on a per capita basis, I think along with Maine, more soldiers than any other state, and more soldiers and Marines. I didn't know that until she showed me the stats. And Maine really surprised me. But she says, "I go to the prisons and I see these veterans, and they're great people. They usually own the prison. They're very well disciplined. They have groups that do things here. I got to do something for them. What can I do?" How do I answer that? So I assume that that's probably true across the country, that it's a considerable percentage of the people overflowing from our prisons now are veterans. This is not good. It's not an indicator that we are, as you said, taking care of those who bore the burden.
Holy smokes. I did not know that. You just had the administration announce implementation of policies that are going to try and reduce the prison population. I assume part of it is the deficit reduction. Effort.
I'm sure. And you know what's caused that. If you've seen Eugene Jarecki's new documentary, The House I Live In, what a condemnation of the drug war. That's really, the drug war has, as he points out so vividly in there, you just grip your seat when you're watching this documentary. It's imprisoned or murdered 15% of the population over the last 30 years.
Right.
It also has corrupted law enforcement. You hear police chief after police chief say, "You know, I don't do anything but drugs.
Right.
Murder, robbery, grand auto. If I have to, I'll go
actually,
after, but I do drugs because that's where the monetary incentives are. That's where the bonuses are. That's where the credit comes from. I do drugs.
Believe it or not, I wrote a book about this, so I'm going to send you a link to it because it's up online.
Please
it's,
do.
My former firm on Wall Street financed a prison company. And it was when I ran into it because the guys financing the prison companies, you know, sort of starting them up and financing them, were lobbying to get the laws changed so that there'd be a lot more prisoners so they could get contracts. And it gets back to this question because as you're describing the, you know, sort of the problems with a hierarchy that's getting more and more political, you're describing it for the military. But I see this in, you know, in the financial world. I see it in the corporate world. I see, you know, it's across our society. And the interesting thing is we've created a financial mechanism with the U.S. Treasury and the way we're financing, you know, that will allow us to run all of these various bureaucracies for political considerations instead of anything related to performance because they can always get more money. You know, but the reality is always getting that more money depends on the military performing. So at some point, you know, performance really matters, and you ask yourself, is there any possible way we can get a revitalization of performance without the entire empire collapsing? I mean, to me, that's the big question here, because because this is across the entire society, and you have throughout society, you know, if you look at who my subscribers are, who are going to be listening to this, I call them the people of the line. They're the people who really know how to make the nuts and bolts go, you know, in oil and gas, in banking. You know, they're just the people who care more about getting the job done than looking great. And they're watching the politicization making, you know, getting the performance. You know, I hate to say it's like Atlas Shrugged, but it's like Atlas Shrugged. And we're all looking at each other saying, okay, you know, how do we bring sanity back to this system? Because the problem is, you know, if I have a company that's getting political and getting away from performance, it eventually goes bankrupt. But we've created a financial mechanism where nothing ever goes bankrupt. You know, we can always kill more people and steal more money. So that's, to me, the big question is a society-wide question. How do we get back to some kind of sane performance? And I wanted to bring up, I don't know if you've seen the latest copy of The Economist, but there's the cover story says Liberty's Lost Decade, from Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib to Bradley Manning and Edward Snowden. And there's an editorial which is, you know, remarkable, coming from the official organ of the Anglo-American Alliance, saying, you know, we've gone too far. We're about to kill the goose that laid the golden egg. And there are a couple paragraphs that sound just like you. So you might want to read it. They probably got it from your writing.
I took The Economist for about 20 years, mainly because I just love their covers. They have the best covers in the world.
Well, I want to know what the official, you know, in my world, I need to know what the official, you know, the official story is. And The Economist is one of a number of periodicals that does a great job of, you know, telling you the official story on a variety of economic matters. But I read it, and it sounded to me like they're saying the same thing, which is, you know, this has gone too far.
I think they're right. I don't have any answers. I hearken back to the 1961 speech by Eisenhower and his farewell address, and not to the part most quoted about the military-industrial complex, but back to the part where he says only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can take care of this situation. And frankly, we have become anything but an alert and knowledgeable citizenry. And that's not to discount everybody across this country, and 320 million or so of us now, I guess. It's simply to say that if you don't function within the democracy in a way that keeps that democracy honest and focused on performance, as you said, and roughly egalitarian as much as can be, that is to say the distribution of wealth is not too grossly out of proportion, all the little things that make a nation great, indeed, from 1950 to 1972, made us the greatest power probably the world has ever seen. If you can't get that kind of focus from almost all of your people all of the time, or some of the time, you can't solve your problems. And the more complex they become, the more you get in a mess. And so I tell my students this all the time. We screwed up, boys and girls, and you're going to have a mess. You're going to be the first generation in American history, as far as I can tell, that as a generation is going to have a lower standard of living than any that preceded it. Let me tell you, that is not something that registers with them in a positive way, I can assure you, but it gets their attention.
Right.
I asked someone, a group of women, 200 women sorority members at William & Mary, I said, show me the hands of any of you who think you will draw Social Security when your time comes. Not a single hand went up. That is an incredible vote of no confidence in your country, particularly in your government.
Right.
So, and until you get these, and one of the reasons I teach is to try to do my little part in this, until you get these people energized and tap their talents for something other than Wall Street. I don't mind some people going to Wall Street who are brilliant, but I like people going to the government who are brilliant, and to state
right.
government who are brilliant, and to local government who are brilliant, and not just interested in filthy lucre, as it were.
I don't think it's just filthy lucre, because what I see is, you know, there's there's upside and there's downside. If you're a federal, state, or local official, and you try to say no to certain interests, you know, you're talking about getting shot, you're talking about getting poisoned, you're talking about physical harassment of you and your children, you're talking about a violent, you know, these are people who not, you know, they don't buy or lobby with money, they buy or lobby with violence. And that, to me, that's the piece that's out of control. And so the question is always, in any system, if you're going to make rules, then how are you going to enforce them? And we don't have a way of enforcing up against an infrastructure that is, you know, and I think that's how the top secret America expenditures have exploded, because the guys lobbying for them, you know, lobby with force.
I don't, you know, I do not disagree with what you've just said. And in my darker moments, I think it's, you know, it's 1848, it's 1790, it's, you pick your year of revolution. Maybe the streets of Cairo right now are a reflection of what's coming more globally. But I, you know, my Virginia friend Thomas Jefferson said the Tree of Liberty had to be, you know, watered with the blood of patriots from now and then. It's not inconceivable to me that we could, people forget that we've had these sorts of periods in our history before. They were, you know, there were some pretty bloody strikes and some pretty bloody things in Pennsylvania, for example.
We need the adults to return. We need adult supervision.
We really do. We really do.
It's
funny you should use that expression. A congressman who had lunch with me recently was talking to me about Richard Bruce Cheney, and he said, you know, there was no real change in Cheney when he became vice president. He was always that way. It's just before he had adult supervision. But when I thought about it, that made a lot of sense.
I think what we've seen is we've seen the steady retirement or disgust of adults. And, you know, the problem is in all these different walks of life, you don't have adult supervision. And to me, that is an economic matter, because when that becomes as obvious and clear, then you lose the goose that laid the golden egg. Well, let me just turn to one last question. You said the Dominionists in the ranks, and this is an issue I don't understand, so I would love it if you would describe it for us.
I'm not an expert on it either. I just joined a group called the Military Religious Freedom Foundation recently, who become major attack objects of some of the, what I would call, Luddites in the Congress, those who have never read, for example, the most eloquent testimony on religious freedom in the world, in my view, Virginia's. I forget the exact title of it. It's Virginia, and Thomas Jefferson put it in Notes on Virginia and Religious Freedom, but the Virginia Act for Religious Freedom, I believe it was. And they simply don't understand what religious freedom means. It means you can be an atheist on the one hand. It means you can believe be a Zoroastrian or a Jedi Knight on the other hand. You can be anything. And when you bring into the military a particular religion, you're bringing that religion into the state, what we rebelled against in terms of Europe. When Thomas Jefferson swore eternal hostility to all forms of tyranny over the mind of man, I'm convinced his writings show his number one object was the priest, his number two object was his own government, and his number three object, which moved up to number one about 1775, was George III. So tyranny comes from a number of different places, but when you put the church in the service of the state, and I don't care what church it is, it can be the Jews, it can be the synagogue, it can be Muslims in the mosque, it can be Christians in the church. When you put them in the service of the state, you ruin things. And the armed forces is an instrument of the state. So when you get commanders ordering people to go to prayer meetings on Wednesday night, ordering people to go to church, ordering people to go to particular churches, when you build mega churches at federal expense on military reservations, you are wrong. And I had no idea that this was going on to the extent that it was until I got associated with this group and I began to learn some of the things that they had compiled, and it scared me.
Well, the other thing is you also get a philosophy that is easily used by the guys trying to juice their stock prices to, you know, people will come to me and say, you know, I just heard this insane reason why we're going to war here, you know, and they start, you know, they believe that that's what we really believe. And I say, no, you know what, the guys, you know, so the following defense contractors can't say we want to make more money this year, so we're going to engineer war. They can't say that. So you got to come up with something about, you know, the Lord has destined us to go, you know, that sounds much better than we want Lockheed stock to go up. So, you know,
it's like the politics of fear. It is an emotion that resonates with a lot of people, and I understand that. And you play that, you opportunistically and in an almost evil way, in my view, you play that to increase your own power and your own money. It's vicious.
Right. And, you know, and it plays in certain places.
Yes,
well,
it does.
Well, if you mentioned the house.
You should see some of the email we get.
You
know, I usually answer with, you know, Mikey or John or Bill, one of the most influential people in my life, if not the most influential people, was my grandmother, who taught Sunday school in the Baptist church for 60 years. She taught first grade for 61 years, because in those days, as long as you could stand up in front of the class, you didn't get retired. I said, she taught me about Jesus Christ. And let me tell you, he would never have sent the email you just sent to me. It's incredible. You know, they want me to die, my wife to die, my children to die, to rot in hell forever.
I know, they're full of hate. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I spent a lot of time in the last 10 to 15 years going to churches. I'm a church, you know, as I travel, you know, I'll go into different churches. Because I wanted to understand how we could be in such a primitive civilization and yet all say we were Christians.
Yes.
So.
It is a mystery.
Okay, well, you had mentioned, I always love to get recommendations for the best books, the best documentaries, the best movies. If somebody wanted to inform themselves more about what you've been talking about, what are some of the best let's just start with documentaries that you would recommend that they watch. You had mentioned The House We Live In on the drug war. Anything that would inform us on the issues facing the Joint Chiefs?
Wow, there are a couple of documentaries that are working right now, and I'm not sure exactly when they're going to come out. I haven't seen it yet, but I've seen some outtakes from it. It's coming out. It's called The Iraq War, and it's interviews with Blair. I believe even Putin's interviewed. These are the same people, forget the name right now, but they're the same people who did the one on the Balkans that included interviews with Milosevic, with Yeltsin and so forth. And they're also the people who did the one on Iran, which included interviews with Ayatollah Khomeini, the new Khamenei, with Ahmadinejad, Rafsanjani, and a host of others. But there are documentaries out there, mostly from this Paris-London-based group on these wars that are very insightful in a lot of the ways we've been talking about. You pick it up sometimes between the lines, but Tony Blair, for example, how he made himself with the Iraq War. I mean, you watch this documentary and you think to yourself, geez, it wasn't just Dick Cheney that did this, it was Tony Blair, too. Now, was this all...
Oh, yeah, Think of all those grateful defense contractors and investors.
Yes, yes, and what he's doing now. Look at what he's doing now. It's just extraordinary. And your first question, I think, is, was this witting or was he just lucky? Did he just make some bad decisions that turned out to be good personally? Was he really, in his soul, did he believe that Iraq could, for example, use WMD in 45 minutes or less? Which he once said. These are riveting documentaries in the sense that you begin to see the decay, I think, and the decadence in the world's leadership right now. And then when you posit that with some of the other documentaries that are coming out on things like climate change, Arctic ice melt, ocean acidification, environmental degradation in general, and you begin to understand that we've got some really, you know, huge challenges confronting us in this century. And you've got this kind of leadership, it becomes pretty scary.
Right. You know, I just have to ask you two questions because we didn't touch on the NSA brouhaha with Snowden. What do you think the effect of that is going to be on the military and the relationship between NSA and the other intelligence agencies in the military?
We have 17 now. And
I know, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. like you said, over $100 billion. And we're looking at most of those being under the control of the Secretary of Defense. I'd say probably, if you wanted a percentage, probably two-thirds, maybe even three-quarters of it, NSA, NRO, and DIA, and so forth. The CIA being the one everybody hears about, which isn't, of course.
Right.
And now the DNI is supposedly over everything with no power over money or people, so all he is really a figurehead. But I can show you the building he's built out here.
He and takes the blame.
Oh, it's incredible. It's just incredible. I went over there for a retirement ceremony, and I thought, what goes on here? The woman who was taking me into the room looked at me and said, oh, you haven't seen anything. Most of it's underground. Holy mackerel. And I think, to your question, I think we're going to have more Snowdens. I think we're going to have we're going to have one every 6 months, I think, because this is really bad, and we do have some young people, particularly, it's interesting, particularly in this IT community, we have some young people who are really, really worried, alarmed, concerned, and they may not be articulate. They may not be operating always on a full deck. Bradley Manning comes to mind. But they are going to be concerned enough, alarmed enough, that they're going to say things. They're the symptom, or they are symptoms. The disease
well, is perpetual war. I think what they see is that this... You know, it's not just, I don't know, you're watching an infrastructure that one, I don't believe, can maintain the mandate of heaven, but the other thing they see is this isn't going to work. You know, it's just, it reminds me, I used to have a pastor in Washington who used to say, God does not bless a mess.
Yeah, and you said it, we're killing the goose that laid the golden egg. We created, after World War II, we created the greatest economic machine the world had ever seen. Manufacturing
right.
was incredible. And now we're just slowly choking it to death.
Well, I believe we're bringing the manufacturing back. That's another conversation, but I think there may be a little twinkling of hope.
I see hopeful signs.
Yeah, I see hopeful signs.
And
I just have to...
just good old hard American work.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
marketing.
And great science and
yes.
technology and engineering.
If we murder our universities like we've murdered our public schools, we will really regret that.
I just watched something BBC did on the Seven Wonders of the Industrial World. It's an old TV series, but it's on the great engineering feats, most of them in the 1900s. And it reminds you of, you know, it takes you back to a culture where we really honored that, we believed we could do it. And unfortunately, I think that part of the problem is our great engineering feats today, too many of them are secret. So we don't get to celebrate them and we don't get to be inspired about them. So, well, I just have to ask you before we close about Putin, because Putin is the real stinker in the ointment on the international stage. And I would say that Putin's not a poodle, whatever he is. In other words, he's a principal. He's not, you know, he's not.
He's a Michael Hayden. He's a John Brennan. He's a former KGB guy. And
yeah.
That's what's running Russia today, along with the so-called Siloviki and the tycoons and so forth, who sort of in a mutual exchange of profit.
Right. But he's a real check, from what I see, on the U.S., unless he's willing to just make deals.
Well, it's become his raison d'etre. That's how
right.
he survives. I saw the
right.
ratings the other day. They were pretty reputable, I think, 66%. Yeah, he's got the opposition movement, and he's got people in the Duma who want to throw rocks at him. But 66% of the Russian people support him. That's all he needs to worry about. And the more he sticks
right.
his finger in Washington's eyes, the more they support him.
Right.
It's called
right.
nationalism.
Right. Okay, well, Colonel Wilkerson, I can't thank you enough for joining us today. This has been unbelievably informative. Before we close, is there anything else you'd like to add? And also tell us how we can stay abreast of what you're doing.
I think what you're doing and the kinds of things across the country that other people like you are doing are very important, because I do think that unless we can wake up a considerable amount of the American people and get them really interested in their government again and in its being good in many respects, if not most, then we may be killing the goose that laid the golden egg.
Oh, no, I agree. But unfortunately, our financial mechanism was too successful, so we're talking about something that's very big and unwieldy.
Yes, yes.
Okay, well, you have a wonderful day, and someday I hope to get you back again.
Thank you, and take care of yourself.
Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.